Accession number 27097, Reel 4.
Morris Grattan, Reel 4. So there were how many were left of you that had started out? It's about 3,000 started out. How many were left by the time?
820 finished really? Up out of the 3,000.
And you still had your mate with you, did you?
Yes, but our other mate had died the night before.
Really?
Yeah.
Who was that?
A chap from Scotland, I forget his name now, but he was in the Argylls. And they marched him. He had jaundice for days. And the night before we were released, he died in the straw. Anyway, we got to this brick factory, as I was saying, and it was three-tiered. You just got everything on top, you know. But I never took my boots off, and I never shaved, and I never washed from January, not until April.
And how were you feeling? How ill were you? Because everyone must have been
ill. Very ill. I was full of lice. I mean, you could take under lice off your shirt and you could put it back on and you'd have another under there within 10 minutes.
And how thin were you?
Oh, I was down very thin, 8 stone something when I came on. So we got in this brick place. And the general trend was, we didn't know how long they were going to keep us there. They only kept us there over one night. But during the day, everybody went out into the brickyard, you know, and pulled down four bricks and sat on them, you know. And there was piles of bricks. But there was every nationality there. I mean, there was every nationality you could think of, you know, and they were dead everywhere. There was dead on the way in and the gutters and everywhere. And it was absolutely wrenched. Anyway, there was a little bit of a cover like there, and it started to rain, and myself and Bob, instead of going inside, decided to sit on these bricks under this little bit of cover outside. Along came a German and he said to me, pick up those piles of bricks, put them on the big pile. And I said, no, I'm not doing that. And I pointed to these false stripes that I'd had. I said, NCO, I'm not doing that. He said, yes, you are. And I said, no, I'm not. So he put a bullet up the spout and out the rifle up to me. And my mate said to me, he said, for God's sake, pick him up. He's going to do it. So I bent down, picked some up, and gradually worked my way around the stack and darted off inside. Anyway, the next day they moved us on. And they stopped us in a farm. And we were all managing, really, then to get cover because the number diminished. And my friend, he had a walking stick and managed to knock a chicken off a cultivator and killed it and shoved it inside my tunic. Took it up into the attic and picked it. And the Jerry's there would only let you have, they let you have five little open fires in the courtyard. So we went down and I went down with my mate and we said to the jury, you know, there were five fires there. We wanted to light another. He said, no. So we said, oh, one cigarette? Yeah. Oh, yes, he'd do it for one cigarette.
This is your supply of cigarettes.
Yeah, which Doug had left me. So we lit this thing and I suppose the chicken had been cut up and was boiling for about 15, 20 minutes, something like that. And then the air raid started again. And the Jerry's kicked all the fires over and put them out. And, of course, my mate, he burnt his hand trying to lift the thing up because if they knew there was chicken inside, we had it, you know. That was good enough. Anyway, we took this chicken up and ate it. It was almost raw. And rat part of it. And you never give nothing away, mind. It was everybody for themselves. So from then on, I got dysentery a bit, and that was worse than ever. For every mile along the road, you had to pull your trousers down. It was terrific. Anyway, we went on. Then, up until we were released, and we were staying in a little place called Alverstadt. And we travelled then about, well, we estimated it was about 1,200 miles. And I got up in the morning, and it just broke daylight. And there was several chaps outside, and the juries were stationed around the building. And I went picking lice out my shirt. And there's a road adjoining this building, and there's some Germans out there knocking the roadblock down. And we thought we could hear tank fire behind us. About another half an hour later, we saw the Americans coming extended line, I should say, from here down to the main road, up across this field. And we just ran for them.
Was this infantry or tanks?
Yeah, infantry. And we ran for them. And I always remember the first words the American said to me or to the rest of us, said, are you Russians? And we said, no, we're British. He said, never. So they told us to get on the road out of the way, but there was a supply column, I should say, must have been 5 miles long, of tanks, equipment, lorries, food, everything. And a German officer came along and threw some food off and told us to stay in the village. Well, they went on and we went in the village. And the German, one of the Germans, I got his bayonet in there. Now I took his bayonet off, got a bayonet from him. And they had a court-martial there, and they shot every German that marched us in the village, yeah.
All the ones that had marched that marched us,
they shot them, yeah.
So, how had they treated you on that long march?
Yeah.
How had these guards treated you on the long march?
Well, not nicely. Not nicely.
Right.
No. I think, really, that they did try to mellow a bit because they knew, I think, it was the end. But, you know, I mean, they used to shoot you if you took a sugar beet or anything from the side of the road. They'd fire at you. They probably wouldn't kill you. But, I mean, they would fire with the intentions of killing you, you know. And anyway, we finished up there. And 820 of us.
Did you see them court-martialing or shooting?
No. We were told about that after. Anyway, went to the first house, and there were three women there. Oh, I should think they were all under 30. And we told them we wanted a room, but we were full of lies. And myself and Bob, they gave us a room there, and they were very nice. And one of the women there was had been to England and had been to college. And out of these three ladies, they'd all lost their husbands. One had lost their husband out in North Africa, and the others had lost them on the Russian front. And they were left with, well, there's three or four children there. And they never knew what a bandage was or anything like that. Everything was paper or, you know. And they never had an egg. Because I remember we had a revolver each from these officers and went down to the farm. The Americans had gone on then, went down the farm, or were going on, and got some eggs out the farmer and took it back and give the little kids some as well as ourselves.
Did you get them from the farmer at gunpoint?
Oh, yeah, at gunpoint, yeah. And then, of course, the other thing was when you were walking up the street, all the German women were begging you to come in because they were afraid of being raped by the blacks, Americans that were, you know, and all those that were coming in the columns, you know, they were afraid of being raped. So, you know, you were invited in. If there was an English bloke in there, they wouldn't come in, you see. So we stayed there for about, a week, just over, I suppose. Then we went and got on a plane and flew down to Brussels, where we were deloused.
I bet that was a pleasure.
Yeah. And then flew back to London and sent a telegram home to say that we're at home and sent down to Chatham.
And how were you being treated by the people in the UK now, by the military?
Oh, very, very good, because, we were on the station with a German sword and doings and that on, and, you know, the MPs and that, they didn't take a bit of notice, you know, so we were all right in that respect, and we were treated very good when we came home. So we came home and sent down to Chatham. They gave us a medical and they wanted me to stay in, and I said no, I'd prefer to go home, and they gave me 3 months leave with double rations. I spent 3 months with double rations. The war then hadn't finished in Germany quite, and I had to report back to Exmouth at the end of the 3 months. At the end of the 3 months, I reported back to Exmouth.
How well were you by now? Were you feeling better?
I was getting better, yeah. I got back to Exmouth, and they said, oh, you've come to the wrong place, they said. You've got to go on commando training down at Ringwood. Not Ringwood, St Margaret's Bay. And I said, well, you told me to come back to Exmouth. It was on my ticket. They said, well, no, you should have gone to Deal. So they said, take a packed lunch. They said, get on the train and go down to Deal. Nothing else, just a warrant for the railway. And this is where the authorities don't know anything about this. I got on the train. And I said, bugger the Marines. Bugger the establishment. They can't hurt me. Nobody can hurt me any more than I've been hurt. So when I got up to Taunton, it was the first on my ticket, with the 1st of August or whatever. And I got off the train and I come on. And I stopped home. Stopped them 3 days and nothing happened, and I thought, well, somebody will soon be calling for me, you know, kind of business. So I went to Taunton and I went across the 1 and made it into a 4, showed the guards up Taunton, you know, they let me get on the train. I went down to Deal and I went to report in down at Deal. Gets down to Deal, and the next thing I heard was, an officer wants to see you. And I thought, well, that's it, you know, I've had it, they tweaked it, you know. I should spend some time down in the prison. So, anyway, it turned out to be Major Curtis. See, he said, gosh, he said, it's good to see you, old chap, he said. he said, I got a good job for you. He said, I want you to be Batman, he said, for Farrier. And I said, I've never been a Batman before in my life. He said, now's your chance. He said, I said, I wouldn't like to do it. He said, we've got no option. So the next thing was, a staff car come down and picked me up, threw my stuff in the back, and I went up to who I told you, General Farrier. Gets up the camp there, signed in, and they said, oh, he's down the house, down on the side there. Went down, he was out. His wife was there. She said, wait a moment, he'll soon be in. And he came in, and he asked where I live, and I told him, and he said, you want to live down? Would you like to bring your wife down here? I said, yes. And he said, well, take another 3 days' leave, he said, and come back, I said. And anyway, I went back and with him, and of course the Japanese war finished, and we were about the first to be demobbed.
What was General Farrier like?
He was a very nice gentleman, yeah, very nice.
What had he done in the war?
Well, he'd been injured out in Crete at one time, I think, and got back, you know. Then I was demobbed.
Right.
You know.
Where did you go to be demobbed?
Down at Deal.
Right.
Yeah.
What was that process like? What was the process like of being demobbed?
Oh, you just went in for a medical. Went for a medical, and the other said, okay, you know, you know, if you went in A1, you. God knows you were hoping to come out A1, but I did not by a long shot. Yeah.
Did you get any sort of pension for your injury?
Oh, well, when I came out, I had a pension for short, and for nerves. I couldn't sleep on a bed. I'd rather sleep on the floor. To talk to you, I would be in one continual sweat. I just didn't have it, you know, it's gone.
Were you able to sleep at night?
No, it was awful and physically, you know.
Was your doctor able to help you with any tablets or?
No, I didn't get a lot of help from the outside doings because actually when I came home after a short leave, I was approached by our village doctor then at the time. He wanted someone to do gardening. I'd done a couple of days for him, and I worked up a gardening business then until I went in the post office.
So how long did it take you to get over sort of mentally and emotionally what you've been through, do you think?
I don't think you really ever get over it. Not really, you know, things stick out in your mind. Sometimes you get horrid dreams about it and whatever, you know. It not really ever goes, you know.
Must have been quite difficult for your wife.
Oh, it was, yes. I'm sure it was, yeah.
Did that cause problems between you?
Not really, not that way, no. I think possibly the physical side of it would have done, you know, because in actual fact, I was just absolutely washed out.
How old were you when you got home?
How old was I when I come out? What would I have been, about 25, late 25.
Very young.
Yeah.
For what you've been through.
Yeah.
So you joined the post office?
Yeah, I went in the post office.
When was that? How long was that before you did that?
No, I worked gardening for nearly 20 years, didn't I?
You went in the post office 1962, didn't you?
Yeah.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
And then you worked there till you retired, did you?
Yes, yeah.
Doing what?
Driving mail vans. Yeah.
Okay. How do you think the military look after their old soldiers? Do you get a pension now? Or?
Yeah, I get a pension now. I never got a pension now. How long have I been having this pension?
5 years. Only about 5 years, have you?
I wouldn't have tried, not really, but to be quite honest with you, after what I went through and how I'm feeling at the time and this, that, the other, we had a gentleman in here that, what was he, anti-aircraft or
yes,
something,
yes.
And he went down to Exeter and said he was deaf and they got a pension for it. And I said, well, if people get pensions like that, I said, the way I feel, surely I should have got something. And I tried and I got something, didn't I?
Yeah.
I should obviously try it before, but I didn't, you know.
Are you satisfied with the amount that you get now?
Well, I am, really. I mean, I don't want to push my luck, you know. I mean, it's... There's other poor fellas out there the same. I mean, I... You know, I know there's people get a lot more than I do, but I'm not envious in that way. You know, it's... I'm just glad to be here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Any other stories come to your mind?
I told you about the tomatoes and yeah. I told you about the... I told you about the NCO. And of course, when I came home, I had these NCO stripes, see, and they'd hardly believe it. I suppose that was the first... things that ever arrived in Germany like that, but at the end of that period, I had about 17 fellas free from going to work.
Really?
Yeah.
And they'd all done the same.
Well,
thing.
We no, well, they.
Oh, you told them.
I told them, and we got it organised and twigged on. Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah, but. They, you see, there's a couple of things in the camp that, you know, that we used to do. I mean, I was rather, well, I suppose looking back on it, reflecting back on it, but daredevil, you know, at the time. But we had a compound right at the end of the camp, which they used to call a Straf compound. And they used to bring prisoners back in there that that been out on the working party and done a misdeed of some kind, you know, like thrown something in the machinery or done something, you know, and came back there for court-martial, you know, or to either be shot or whatever. And I helped some of them out one night, but... it turned out to be no avail. I mean, they stood us out on the parade ground for 7 hours and, you know, stood the chap up against the wall and actually killed one right in our view, you know.
What, they were making you watch them?
Well, you see, what happened? They had the Straf compound. And if you could divert the attention of the Germans and get them to break out, they could easier break out within the camp than they could to get outside the camp, you see. And we used to, you know, get up to all kinds of mischief, you know, to divert the Germans so that some of these guys could get out the Straflager. Well, if they got out the Straflager, you see, the next thing the Germans used to do, you know, they used to have a roll call of all that was in the camp, you see, and try and find out, you know, where they got out and how they got out, you know. And
so what would you do to divert them?
Well, we used to, at night, you know, draw a fake ladder out and throw it against the fence, you know, and... Then the sirens used to go, you see. And the sirens went. That what the Germans used to do, they used to withdraw all the guards within the camp and put them out round the camp, you see. So as soon as ever they'd done that, it was free inside for people to mingle, you see. They didn't worry about what was inside. They were worrying about what was getting outside. And that's how we used to divert them. I mean, the searchlights used to go around, and you used to be crawling on your belly and you used to think to yourself, you're going to get it in a minute, But, I mean, some of the things in the camp was cunningly concealed that you wouldn't believe it. I never believed several of the things in the camp. I mean, they had at the end of one compound, they had a breakout place where they used to have a table about 8 foot long, about 4 foot wide. It used to have a cupboard with a couple of blankets. And nobody took any notice of that whatsoever. It was right near the wire, and they used to, if a chap used to get a Red Cross parcel with a scarf in and he already had one, he'd put it on there to swap with something else. You see, it was like a swap counter. But it wasn't only a swap counter, it was an escape counter. All that went on with underneath that blanket.
What were they digging?
You're digging, you wouldn't believe. And of course, nearly all the camps, see, was all built on sand. The other thing was, took some shoring up, so there was a lot of bedboards short everywhere, because, I mean, if you had 8 or 9 bedboards, some of them on Port Saps were sleeping on about 4, I reckon.
Well, it's been a fascinating story. It really has. So I'll say thank you very much indeed.
That's all right.
Maurice Grattan, end of reel 4.